Today, we will study the history of the universe. I will start with an overview of the various epochs. And then towards the end, we will discuss how special this is and why, therefore, special explanations are needed. This is not, the universe doesn't just present itself as being in some messy generic state, but it is behaving in a very special way, and that needs some explanation, and we start looking into these explanations then. So here I'm plotting the timeline of the history of the universe. Roughly speaking, a lot happened in the first second, then something super important happened about 100,000 years in, and then things happened on the timescale of billions of years. In order to display that on a time axis in such a way that not everything is squished to the one end, I'm using a logarithmic time axis. So we have here on one end the Planck time, 10 to the minus 43 seconds, which is the analog of the Planck length. It's the time that light takes to cross a Planck length, 10 to the minus 35 meters. And nobody knows what happened there at that time scale. And here is today, and that is the far future. When we speak of the age of the universe, we are implicitly assuming a particular kind of time variable. Because obviously, a neutrino, for example, that was produced very early in the universe might have been traveling so fast that if we catch it today and interview it, how old is the universe? It will say 2 weeks, right? Because it was so fast that for it, its own time passed so slowly that like the universe is 2 weeks old. That's a totally valid thing. So what do we mean when we say that the universe is 13.8 billion years old? It means this is the time on the wristwatch of a traveler who has been co-moving with the universe from the beginning. So a free-falling observer who is at rest relative to the galaxies. So he's not having any peculiar velocity, any extra velocity relative to the average motion of the galaxies. So the cosmic rest frame, so to speak. So that's the time we are talking about here. Let's go from right to left. So here we have today, which is about 10 to the 19 seconds in. And as we discussed last time, at the moment, dark energy dominates the energy momentum tensor. So the energy momentum tensor is dominated by a contribution from something that looks like a cosmological constant. That is about 70% of what is in the energy momentum tensor. If the energy momentum tensor consisted of only a cosmological constant, then the energy momentum tensor would have some positive number in the zero-zero component and the same number, but negative, in the pressure slots, the II components, which means that the ratio between pressure and energy would be minus one. The W parameter would be minus one. It's not minus one, as far as we assume now. If the cosmological constant contributes about 70%, we should be close to minus one, but not quite minus one. There's confusing experimental evidence about this, actually. There's some experiments that would say, yeah, the W parameter is about minus one, but there's a fair chance it's smaller than minus one. Now, if you remember our discussion of last lecture, we don't really have a mechanism to explain why W could ever be smaller than minus one. Physically, it would be super weird. As you will see in today's lecture, it would mean that the universe would expand faster than exponentially fast. It would also mean that the energy density in the vacuum does not dilute. Instead, it would actually increase. It would mean that as you try to dilute the energy density, as you expand the universe, the energy density actually increases. There's some experimental evidence that apparently is compatible with what we see. No positive evidence pointing towards it, but it's within the error bars. Okay, so in the future, well, we don't know quite what will happen in the future, but this is how it looks like. At the moment, cosmological constant is dominating. Since the universe is expanding, matter and radiation are getting further and further diluted. And that means that the cosmological constant will start to dominate, will dominate the energy momentum tensor more and more until matter and radiation are almost completely diluted away just because of the expansion. And then W should be pretty much minus one, and the universe should be expanding pretty much exponentially. On the other end, what do we have? We have here, according to the current standard model of cosmology, that at the beginning of the universe, the very beginning I'll tell you a little bit later on about, so shortly after the beginning, there was a period of inflation, which is to say of exponential or accelerated expansion, which didn't last very long, basically from 10 to the minus 43 seconds, presumably, until about 10 to the minus 32 seconds. And that was a period of accelerated expansion. The W parameter was maybe not exactly minus one, but close to minus one during that time. So curiously, we have the behavior that the W parameter is close to minus one, and we have almost exponential expansion both at the beginning and at the end. I mean, we don't know whether there's going to be an end, but we have it at both ends of this display here. Okay, so we had a period at the very early universe, up to 10 to the minus 32 seconds, when the W parameter was almost minus one, and the universe expanded very rapidly. We think that this initial expansion was caused by a fluctuation of the so-called inflaton field, which had temporarily, in a small region of space, an energy density that was very high. And as you will see again today, if the energy density is very high locally, without much of a gradient, just high, then that will dominate the energy momentum tensor and drive the W parameter, the ratio of the 0,0 component and the II component of the energy momentum tensor, towards minus one. But then eventually, that relaxed, that fluctuation came back to zero, and all the energy that was in that fluctuation then turned into the production of particles. So initially, it was just a quantum fluctuation that elevated the potential of the Klein-Gordon field, of the Higgs, of the inflaton field. That led to an expansion of the universe, but eventually that potential dropped down again. We will study the equations of motion for that later in more detail. And then that energy had to go somewhere, and it went into the production of particles. So at 10 to the minus 32 seconds, the universe was already big because of the expansion. It was already flat because of the expansion that flattened everything out. And it was filled with a soup of very, very hot particles produced from the decay of that potential. So that this is a period of reheating. This is where the Big Bang starts. It doesn't start here, it starts there. It's where we have a hot, dense, flat, large universe. And then the universe was dominated by that hot plasma of particles for about the period from 10 to the minus 32 seconds to about 10 to the 13 seconds. And what then happened is that the energy momentum tensor was no longer dominated by radiation. It was then dominated by matter. So let's see. In the first period, inflation, which was a period of accelerated expansion caused by the elevation of the potential of the infratron field. During that time, the energy momentum tensor was dominated by the potential of the infratron field, and there was virtually no matter. If there was pre-existing matter around, it was tremendously diluted by the huge expansion of the space-time. For example, it is thought that at Planck energies, Planck times, all sorts of processes should have been able to take place, including the production, for example, of monopoles, magnetic monopoles, and other exotic particles. We don't see them today. But that could be explained by this huge expansion. They would be around, but so diluted that we don't usually come across them. Anyway, so in that first period, we had the W was close to minus 1, and the energy momentum tensor was dominated by the potential of the inflaton field, a scalar field that obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. Then that potential dropped, the energy went into the production of particles. A hot, dense plasma. What's a plasma? As opposed to a gas, a plasma is fully ionized. See, if you take a gas and heat it up further, you get another phase transition. You don't just go from solid to liquid to gas. If you heat further, that gas, for example, the air, would become a plasma. It's when the molecules or atoms are so fast that the electrons can no longer stick to the nuclei. So everything becomes ionized. So you had the universe filled with this very, very hot plasma. And that was basically, I mean, it was all the charges went around, like electrons, quarks, and so on. And there was lots of light, lots of photons. And overall, the energy momentum tensor was dominated by the radiation. But then remember what we saw earlier. When the universe expands, matter gets diluted in the expected way. Namely, as, for example, the volume doubles, well, the density has to drop by a factor of 2 then, right? But of matter, but not of radiation. Because radiation gets not only diluted, it's not only that the density of photons gets diluted as the volume increases. No, the photons also get their wavelength stretched, which is at the expense of their energy. So the energy momentum tensor loses its contribution from the radiation faster than from matter. Because the energy momentum tensor loses its contribution from the radiation at the rate of length of a box to the fourth power. And the energy density due to matter only goes down like length to the third power, like the volume. Right? So radiation dilutes like 1 over length to the third power because of the volume effect, dilution, but also 1 over length because of the lengthening of the wavelength. So that unavoidably, therefore, the era of radiation domination had to end, and then there came an era of matter domination. But eventually, matter was so diluted, and that happened a few billion years ago, that a cosmological constant, which presumably was present all the time, but pretty small, that cosmological constant then came to the foreground. It didn't grow, it just stayed constant, but the energy density in radiation dropped fast, then matter dropped not quite as fast, so it became the dominant one, and eventually matter diluted so much, a few billion years ago, that it started to contribute less to the energy momentum tensor than the cosmological constant has always been contributing. So in the future then, the cosmological constant will take over and lead to a quasi-exponential expansion there. Okay, now what happened here exactly? I wrote a few things there. As I said, the energy in that energy fluctuation of the inflaton field, when that inflaton potential dropped to zero, then that energy went into the production of this hot plasma, of all sorts of particles. So the universe was filled with hot plasma at that point in time. And then, that was about 10 to the minus 32 seconds in. And then at about 10 to the 0 seconds, which is to say at about 1 second, when the universe was about 1 second old, that plasma had cooled down to the extent that the nuclei held together, which means that the quarks, condensed into nuclei and into pions. The universe was about 1 second old when that happened. And then about 100,000 years, when the universe was about 100,000 years old, the plasma had cooled to such an extent that it reached only a few thousand Kelvin, on the order of 1,000 Kelvin. And at 1,000 Kelvin, the plasma stops being a plasma, because then the electrons will stick to the nuclei. They're no longer hot enough, they're no longer fast enough to escape the nuclei. This is when the primordial hydrogen formed, right? So we had all the protons around and the electrons, but they were too fast up until then, up until about 100,000 years. And then they started to stick together and formed hydrogen. That made a huge difference in the universe. Because while before, the protons and the electrons were just moving along freely, interacting with each other, but just bouncing off each other, being too energetic to form bound states. In that period, when the universe was a plasma of charged particles, light couldn't travel very far. Because light, photons, interact with charges. And there were charges all over the place, free charges. But then when the universe was about 100,000 years old, the electrons and the protons found each other and formed hydrogen and a little bit of helium. And hydrogen and helium are gases that are transparent, which means that suddenly, when that phase transition from plasma to gas happened, suddenly the universe became transparent. While filled with the plasma, it was not transparent, and the mean free path of photons was very short. But then as soon as it became transparent, light could travel freely. In fact, photons that were around at that time, that had just been produced by the plasma, but now suddenly the plasma had turned transparent because it became a gas, those photons, most of them, are still traveling. Because suddenly the universe became completely transparent. And so those photons have been traveling for 13.8 billion years. At the time when that phase transition happened, the universe was about 1,000 Kelvin hot. And so the light was pretty bright. It was hot. It was like the heat radiation from a flame that's 100,000 degrees hot. Right? That would burn you. It's pretty hot. I mean, it's not as hot as, I mean, it's not as white as the light from the sun, because the surface of the sun has 6,000 degrees. Right? So it would be kind of a red light. But it's still, it's visible and hot. More like a flame. It's not like the surface of the sun at 6,000 Kelvin, but if you have a flame of a gas lamp or something like that, you give it a lot of oxygen, it might reach 1,000 degrees. So the universe became transparent in that phase transition from plasma to gas, when it was about 1,000 degrees. So the heat radiation of that time was that hot and is still traveling today. So where is it? Can we see it? The thing is that the universe has expanded since tremendously. And so all those photons had their wavelengths stretched. And therefore, these photons no longer correspond to a distribution of 1,000 Kelvin, but now they have a spectrum which is that of heat radiation at 2.7 Kelvin, which is super cold. And the photons are no longer in the optical range. You see, if you heat something up to 1,000 degrees, you can see the heat radiation. If you cool something down to 2.7 degrees, it still emits heat radiation because its charges are still moving around. So it's still you know, all the atoms in an object always act like, when they move around, it's just acting like an antenna. You have charges moving around, right? So even at 2.7 Kelvin, stuff is still emitting heat radiation, even though it's not much of a heat, right? It's like cold radiation, 2.7 Kelvin. And the visible light has wavelengths in the hundreds of nanometers, right? Like green is like 500 nanometers or something. The same photons today after having traveled to the universe, while the universe expanded by a tremendous factor, no longer have a wavelength of like hundreds of nanometers. Now they have a wavelength in the centimeters. So the universe has correspondingly stretched by that factor since. And of course, these photons are what we now call the cosmic microwave background radiation. These are the leftover photons from the plasma when suddenly the universe became transparent and they just started traveling freely. Now you may wonder, how do we know this stuff? Like, when that phase transition happened, at what temperature? Well, we know when that temperature happened. I mean, at what temperature the phase transition from plasma to gas happens, because we can recreate that in the lab. It's not difficult to produce a few thousand Kelvin in the lab. You can take hydrogen gas and make it so hot that it becomes a plasma. And you can check at what temperature that happens. And you can calculate how much compression you need of the hydrogen gas, running the clock backwards numerically. You know, you can calculate what compression you need, therefore what time you need, such that it was so hot that that phase transition happened. But then, here, how about this one? About 1 second in, when the universe was about 1 second old, nuclei formed. How do we know about this part? What do we know about, you know, phase transitions in the strong interaction? Well, we know about it because we, again, can recreate that in accelerators. You can smash nuclei into each other, and then there's already evidence that shows that you can basically create a phase transition in the quarks and gluons that form nuclei. So that's experimentally being explored. And you may wonder, how far can we go with accelerators? You see, as we go earlier and earlier in time, we are looking at interactions that are more and more energetic. Because that's where the universe is cold, this is where it's really, really hot, right? So the time scale is also temperature scale. And the temperature scale is an energy scale. So all the processes that we think happened here, in principle, we can try to recreate in an accelerator. But how far can we go? For example, at CERN, if we smash particles against each other, then that corresponds to the heat simply smashing particles together early in the universe. Right? If you take a point in time here and ask what was the temperature, okay, this many degrees, that means that particles typically smashed into each other with that much of energy. And then you can ask, can I recreate that in an accelerator? How far can I go? How far back in time can I simulate, or not simulate, but probe, experimentally probe the physics of collisions that happened in the early universe? And amazingly, with the accelerators, we can recreate all of the physics of the early universe all the way back to when the universe was about 10 to the minus 11 seconds old. All of that we can do in the lab. When the universe was about 10 to the 11 seconds old, the temperature was such that the typical collisions were about 1 TeV, of the order of a TeV, a tera electron volt, which is what CERN can now, what the LHC can routinely do. Of course, there's way more to go that we cannot access, but it's quite tremendous that we can probe by other means all the physics of the early universe back to 10 to the minus 11 seconds. All right. Oh, yes. These sections of time where the energy momentum tensor was dominated by one particular kind of contribution are called epochs. So this was the epoch of inflation. The energy momentum tensor was dominated by a large potential of a scalar field, and therefore the W parameter was pretty much constant at a value of around minus one. Then here we have the epoch of radiation domination. And we know that when radiation dominates the energy momentum tensor, we can calculate that using the Maxwell equations, when we have heat radiation dominating the energy momentum tensor, then the ratio of pressure to energy density is a third, which means during that period, the energy momentum tensor had a W parameter of a third. And then here we have another epoch where the energy momentum tensor is dominated by matter, which we can think of as dust, in which case the pressure would be zero. So the W parameter is pretty much zero. So it went from minus one to plus one third to zero. And now that the cosmological constant is taking over, the W parameter goes down to about minus one again. In fact, it might be already minus one or even exceed minus one. So overall, we have an evolution in the universe where the W parameter went from close to minus one to a third to zero to about minus one again. And the W parameter is super important because as we saw last time and as we will go through in more detail today, once you know the W parameters in an epoch, you can calculate how the scale factor of the universe behaves. You can use the W parameter in the continuity equation, solve it, and then plug that into the Friedmann equation, solve that, and then you get the scale factor as a function of time. So you get the rate at which the universe expanded depending on the W parameter. And the project for the course is, of course, you playing around with that. Here we have a universe that starts with W parameter close to minus one, then goes up to a third, then goes down to zero, then goes to minus one. What if the universe underwent some other W parameter? How does it behave? How does the expansion of the universe, how does the rate of expansion of the universe respond to changes in W? See, changes in W arise from changes in the matter. Now, since as humans exposed to our regular environment, we have no experience changing the energy momentum tensor and then seeing how the universe reacts. It's something that we need to try out numerically or analytically to get a feeling for. After all, the two ends of the scale we don't understand yet. We don't know what's going to happen, and we don't really know what happened over there. So it's good to get a feel for what the Einstein equations do, what the relationship is, the most fundamental relationship between matter and space-time on the cosmological scale. If matter does this, in the simplest case expressed through W, what does the space-time do? So that's the overall question that you have to play with in the project. All right, so evolution of the Friedmann-Lemaître space-times for each one of these epochs. As we said, for each epoch, you can solve the continuity equation and solve the Friedmann equation, and then you get the time evolution of the space-time. So in other words, you input what you think you know about the matter, namely what the W parameter is the energy momentum tensor radiation dominated or cosmological constant dominated, etc. And the output is A of t, the scale factor, the behavior of the scale factor as a function of time. All right, so depending on what is the dominant contribution to the energy momentum tensor, there's always an effective equation of state. Equation of state is the pressure as a function of the energy density. And then we said that during periods of time in which the equation of state can be approximated by a constant, by saying that the pressure is some constant times the energy density, such periods of time for constant W we call a cosmic epoch, like the epoch of radiation domination. And then during these epochs, remember we had that during the radiation-dominated epoch, W is a third. During a matter, dust-dominated epoch, W is zero. Dark energy-dominated epoch has W equal to minus one. Now, for any given epoch, we use its equation of state to solve the continuity equation. Remember, here's the continuity equation. Here is basically the energy content in a volume, energy density times scale factor to the third. And how does that change as we change the scale, as we increase the size of the universe? It's given by minus 3 times the pressure A squared. Remember, this is essentially the general relativistic version of the statement that if you compress a box or you decompress a box, you either invest energy or you get energy out, and you can calculate that from the pressure, right? Because you are doing work against the pressure. The pressure produces a force. So how much work you do against the pressure determines how much energy you're pumping into the box or getting out of it. So there's a relationship between the pressure on one hand and the energy density on the other hand. That is that relationship. And we saw that there's an intuitive derivation for it. But then I also gave you the detailed calculation that it shows that it's still true in general relativity. Okay, so this is the continuity equation in general. Now, during an epoch, the continuity equation simplifies, because we don't just have P of rho with some unknown function P of rho that says what the pressure does as a function of the energy density. No, an epoch is characterized by P being proportional to rho with a proportionality factor being W. That is to say, the general continuity equation during an epoch is simply this. This is just the same as the left-hand side over there. But on the right-hand side, instead of having minus 3 P A squared, we have minus 3, and then the A squared is just carried forward, and then we have W rho, because in an epoch, we have P is equal to W rho. The point of this is that, of course, now we eliminated the P in here, and it's just a differential equation for the rho as a function of A. So here we now have, during an epoch, that the continuity equation becomes a differential equation for rho of A. And not even a difficult one. This is the general solution of it. See, it's a first order differential equation. We just need one initial condition to solve it. And here's the general solution. The energy density as a function of the scale factor is some initial energy density rho naught times A to the power minus 3 W plus 1. So we solved it for all values of W. I leave it to you as an exercise to plug that into this differential equation and verify that it solves it. Let us look at the three special cases that we keep considering: radiation domination, matter domination, and cosmological constant domination. So for matter domination, the universe is filled with the dust of galaxies, for example, then W is equal to zero, because the pressure is zero. We just have energy density but no pressure. For W equal to zero, we have here that the energy density goes like a constant times A to the power of minus 3, because W is equal to zero. But that's just what you would expect, right? The energy density dilutes like A to the minus 3. Because A to the third is like a volume, right? If you take a box in the universe and you track its volume over time, then as the scale factor increases, A increases, the box increases, the volume of the box goes like A to the power of 3. So the dilution of matter goes simply by 1 over the volume, as we discussed earlier. Now, in the radiation-dominated case, W is 1/3. So the pressure is 1/3 of the energy density in suitable units in the energy momentum tensor. In this case, well, let's plug in 1/3 here. Then we have 4/3 up here, 4/3, right? 1/3 plus 1. And that means A to the power minus 4. That's again what we discussed earlier. The energy density in radiation should dilute faster than the energy density in matter, because it should dilute for two reasons. One, the photons become rarer because they just get diluted because the universe expands. But also, the wavelength of each photon should get stretched as it moves because the universe expands underneath it. And that leads to an extra factor of 1 over a, because of the stretching of the wavelength. And so the energy density goes like a to the power minus 4. We just derived that here. And then let's look at the case of a cosmological constant. Now in this case, W is minus 1. So if W is equal to minus 1, then we have here a to the power of 0, which is to say the energy density is constant. And this shows pretty clearly how weird a cosmological constant is, because it means that it represents an energy density that doesn't dilute at all. See, it means that there is an energy distribution in the universe, and even though the universe expands, its volume, the volume of any box is increasing, the energy density stays the same. So the box just acquires more and more energy. What would happen if W was smaller than minus 1? If W was smaller than minus 1, then, let's look at it, then we have smaller than minus 1 plus 1. That's still smaller than 0. That's still negative here, right? So we get some negative number multiplying some negative number that's positive, which means we have that the energy density goes like a to some positive power. That would be super weird, because it would mean that as the universe is expanding, the energy density is increasing, which means that the universe would accelerate even faster. So it's not accelerating at a constant rate, but it would be accelerating at an accelerated rate. And as we will later see, this means that the universe would actually come to an end, because everything would be ripped apart. You would reach, every box would not just expand in time, it would expand to an infinite volume, being completely ripped apart in a finite amount of time. So if W is smaller than minus 1, we have some big fireworks to look forward to. But it's way too early to speculate about the future of the universe. We don't know enough about the cosmological constant and things like that. All right, so what we did so far is this. We picked an epoch. That is to say, we assume we are looking now at a period of time where W is pretty much constant. Then we plugged the W value in the continuity equation. That was a differential equation which we could solve in generality. And we got rho as a function of A. So we found out how the energy density dilutes as the universe is expanding. Now, that rho of A we can use to turn the Friedmann equation, remember that's the T naught naught, it's a zero component of the Einstein equation. We can use the continuity equation to turn the zero zero component of the Einstein equation, the Friedmann equation, into a differential equation for A. And once we have that, once we can solve that, we get A of T. We get the rate at which the trajectory of the size of the universe. Once we have A of T, we can then, of course, also calculate rho of T. So everything falls in place then at that point. By the way, where did the second Einstein equation go? We're using here the Friedmann equation, which is the zero zero component of the Einstein equation. But there were also the II components of the Einstein equation. How come we can solve the whole problem without using the II components? Or did we use them somehow? We did. In the derivation of the continuity equation, both went into it, the 0,0 component and the 1,1 component, or the 2,2 or 3,3, right? So we're not neglecting it. It's just in the continuity equation that we use to solve for rho of A. Anyway, so here we have the Friedmann equation. And we can now plug in the rho. Normally, this would be, we would write here the A of T and so on. And here we have rho of T, but we now have rho of A. Also, in principle, the Friedmann equation has here an additional term, which is the cosmological constant. But by convention, one usually lumps the cosmological constant together with the energy momentum tensor. Logical, and so let's say historically, the cosmological constant arose on the left-hand side of the Einstein equation, together with the curvature. It arises with the Sakharov-induced gravity mechanism of creating these terms. But in practice today, we move the cosmological constant to the other side of the Einstein equation, where the energy momentum tensor is, and we just incorporate it in the energy momentum tensor. Therefore, henceforth, when we write the energy density, we allow this to contain all contributions to the zero-zero component of the energy momentum tensor, whether they be radiation, matter, dark matter, or the cosmological constant. So we are no longer treating the cosmological constant as separate from the energy momentum tensor, but for notational convenience, we consider it incorporated in the energy momentum tensor. All right, so here we have the Friedmann equation. Now, let us look at the case where k is equal to zero. Before we solve that equation, let's agree to solve it for the case k equal to zero. Remember, k took the values minus 1, 0, or 1, depending on whether the universe was hyperbolic or flat or elliptic. So for k equal to 0, the universe is spatially simply R3. And the observational evidence is that as far as we can measure it, the universe is on large scales basically R3. There are, of course, dents in there because of all the matter that's moving around. But overall, the universe is pretty much flat. It's basically R3. We have no evidence for it to close, so that k would be positive or that it would be an open hyperbolic universe. No evidence for that. So at least a very good approximation to say that k is equal to zero. Now, let us solve that equation for A. You see, rho of A, I wrote here just rho of A, but remember that from the steps before, using the continuity equation, rho of A is an explicit function during an epoch. Like if it's a radiation-dominated epoch, rho of A is simply rho naught A to the power of minus 4. If it's a matter-dominated epoch, then this is rho naught A to the power of minus 3. And if it's the cosmological constant-dominated epoch, then this is simply rho naught. No A dependence. So this is just a differential equation for A, right? It's like A dot and A. That's all it contains. Since it's first order, it's just first derivative energy, you just need one initial condition, one integration constant. And we can solve that. We can solve that differential equation here for A of t. And here's the answer. So we get now how the scale factor of the universe, the stretching factor of the universe, how that depends on time as a function of time, where t naught is some, it's the integration constant. It's some parameter of unit time. And here we have the W parameter. So during an epoch when the W parameter is constant, this is how the scale factor behaves. Now you have to be careful. If the W parameter changes, you cannot simply put here W of t and then assume that this still works, because it's got to go through the differential equations, which is something you can explore, right? You can explore, for example, in ordinary standard cosmology, we assume that there's a period of, there's this epoch with this W value, that epoch with that W value, and that epoch with that W value, etc., right? But what happens when the W value changes quickly? What happens there? Is that really just a change of the W parameter and the scale factor just changes accordingly? Or does the differential equation get a hiccup in this? Right? Because you get derivatives. How does the derivative of W get into it? And if so, can you have that a fast phase transition can do something extra? Explore that. I mean, it's one of the things you may want to explore. All right, so what do we have here? We have here the scale factor as a function of time and as a function of w. What happens if w is equal to minus 1? You see there's a trouble here, because then we divide by 0. So this is the solution for all cases where w is not minus 1. So the cosmological constant dominated energy momentum tensor has a Friedmann equation for which this is not the solution. We'll later see what the solution is for the case w is equal to minus 1, but for all other cases, this is the solution. And let's look at it. How does it behave? Well, it tells us that the scale factor of the universe behaves as a function of time as some power of t, as some power of the time. Right? It's t to the power of something. This is just there to make the units right. Because if you take t to some power, you can't do that. You can't take seconds to the power of 3/2 or something like that, right? So this is just there to make this unit less. And then, so we have the time to some power. And which power it is depends on w. So the equation of state parameter tells us what power that is. And obviously, we should expect that there's a huge difference between this being a power that is, you know, larger or smaller. Like if this is t to the power 5, it'll go like this. If this is t to the power of 1/2, it will not go like that. It will go like this, right? It will go like a square root. We will see that. Also, since the Friedmann equation contains a dot squared only, not a alone, you can always replace a dot by minus a dot. In other words, any solution forward in time is also a solution backward in time. For every expanding universe solution, you can just flip t to minus t and you get a shrinking universe solution. Okay, so this is the general set of solutions for k equal to 0 and w not equal to minus 1. Here it is again, that's the general solution up here. Now let's look at the specific cases that we considered most. Radiation domination has w equal to 1/3. In this case, if w is equal to 1/3, we have 4/3. The thirds cancel away. We have 2 divided by 4, that's a 1/2. So we have that the scale factor goes like the square root of t. So therefore, the scale factor during such an epoch goes like that, like a piece of the square root. So during a radiation-dominated period, the scale factor behaves like a piece of a square root function. During a matter-dominated period, w is equal to 0, then we have here 2/3. So now the scale factor behaves like, goes like t to the power 2/3. That looks not so different from a square root. But then another case that comes up very much, in fact, is very close to what we think how the universe behaved during the initial epoch of inflation. We have a situation where the universe expanded with a behavior that was t to the power r, with r very large. This means that the universe had a scale factor that went like this, right? If r is like 1,000 or 1,000,000, then t to the power 1,000,000 goes pretty steeply. Not quite as steeply as an exponential would, but the higher the power is, the more it tries to catch up to an exponential. This is what is called the power law inflation. It's a power law expansion of the universe. If you want to describe an expansion with a power of r, then, because of that formula over there, the w parameter has to be minus 1 plus 2 divided by 3r. Let's look at that equation for a moment. What does that mean? It means that if the w parameter is close to minus 1, but it's not exactly minus 1. It's just close to it. It's a little bit larger. This is, see, for large r, this is a small number. So if the W parameter is minus 1 plus a small number, then you can read off from that small number what the r is, and then you can tell, aha, this is how fast the universe is expanding, t to the power of r. Okay? So if this, if the W parameter during a particular epoch is minus 1 plus a millionth, then this is 1 divided by a million. You can work out what the r is, basically a million. So you get that the universe expands like t to the power 1 million. And remember that this is where the universe is heading now. The cosmological constant, if the cosmological constant is already dominating, but we still have some contribution from the matter and radiation in the universe. But that contribution is going to get diluted. And so, as we do, the universe is going to expand with a power law, t to the power r, but that r is actually increasing. But remember, we have to be careful with these arguments, because all of this has been derived under the assumption that the W parameter is constant. But then, if you try it numerically, you can make this W change in time. For example, study exactly what happens as you go from a matter-dominated universe through dilution into a cosmological constant-dominated universe. Because then that contribution gets smaller and smaller. Intuitively, this means this has to go up, except we're not allowed to have a time-dependent R, a time-dependent W, because we solve the equations of motion of the assumption that W and R are constant. But numerically, you can solve the thing through. Well, and what is the solution? What is the scale factor's behavior if W is exactly minus 1? This thing is divergent then, right? R would have to be infinite in order to have W equal to minus 1. The solution is not good there. And it's not going to be t to the power infinite. No, if you solve the equations of motion, if you solve the differential equation, the Friedmann equation, for the case W exactly minus 1, you can solve it. It's just not going to be a power law. It's going to be this. It's going to be an exponential. I leave it to you as an exercise, or you can also do it in the project then to solve the equation for that. All right, so let us look at these four cases again. Here we have radiation domination, matter domination. And you see this goes like t to the power 1/2, t to the power 2/3. And see, it's an expansion that's slowing down. See, the a of t is increasing, but it's increasing at a decreasing rate. The slope is decreasing. Here, however, in power law, or in dark energy dominated universe, we have that not only is the scale factor increasing, the slope is also increasing. It's an accelerated expansion. When do we have accelerated expansion? When do we have that A double dot is larger than 0? Well, let's see. We want A double dot larger than 0. A double dot larger than 0 requires that W is smaller than minus 1/3. Let's see what happens when we choose W minus 1/3. If W is exactly minus 1/3, then what do we have here? Then we have 1 minus 1/3. That's 2/3. That cancels exactly what we have here, right? It's just 1. So therefore, at W equal to minus 1/3, the A of t is just proportional to t. It's just t, which means it's the borderline case between this behavior of decelerating expansion and that behavior of accelerating expansion. It's when the expansion is simply a straight line. Just proportional t. So the borderline case between those two is the case where W is equal to minus 1/3. And all those cases where the universe is expanding at an accelerated rate, are called inflationary. So the definition of inflation, of an inflationary epoch, is that it's an epoch during which the equation of state parameter was smaller than minus one-third, because it means that this curve is bending upwards. Okay, let's have another look at the most likely timeline. I plotted also the balance that we have now. So the best fit today is that k is equal to zero, so that spatially the universe is basically R3 up to some perturbations locally, that the cosmological constant contributes 70% to the energy momentum tensor, that matter dominates the remaining 30% to the energy momentum tensor, and that matter consists of two contributions: the visible matter in the form of stars and planets and light, which is 10% of all matter, and then dark matter, which is 90% of all matter. So that means that visible matter is 10% of 30%, 3%. Right? So 3% of the energy momentum tensor in the universe we can account for. It's the visible stuff. And 97% is either dark matter or dark energy. I mean, cosmological constant or dark matter. There's lots of room to discover things. All right, so I described at the beginning of this lecture today this period of inflation, a period where the W parameter would have been very close to minus 1. Minus 1 plus some epsilon, presumably, which is very small. What's the evidence? What does the model of having a period of exponential, of almost exponential inflation solve? What does it explain? What evidence is there that needs to be explained by assuming such a dramatic assumption, like the universe expanding within 10 to the minus 32 seconds so much that it basically went from, that even the tiniest pieces went to cosmological scales? Why inflation? Here's one of the problems that led people to postulate that there ought to have been a period of inflation at the beginning. That was the original problem that needed to be solved, the original reason for why inflation was postulated. Let us reconsider the experimental finding that the universe is, on large scales, pretty much flat. K equals zero. Universe is, on large scales, pretty much R3. What I'm going to show you now is that this finding is not stable. So if the universe is flat now, it's basically described by R3, with a tiny perturbation, so let's say it's a little bit, has a little bit of net positive curvature, and then we run the evolution of the universe forward, we will find that that net curvature will increase. If the universe today has a little bit of negative curvature, and we run the Einstein equation forward in time, we will find that in the future it will have much more negative curvature. So you see, the zero curvature case, the k equals zero case, is not stable. Under the Einstein equation, any positive curvature will become a much larger positive curvature. Any negative curvature will become a much larger negative curvature. But that means if we run things backwards in time, if we look at the past, then we must conclude that if the universe is today flat with a pretty good accuracy, it must have been super flat in the past. It must have been extremely close to being R3, so that it still today is pretty much R3, because the evolution of the Einstein equation would drive it away from that. It would make positive curvature way bigger and negative curvature way smaller. So let's see how that happens and how the period of inflation could explain why the universe is so flat today. Okay, so let us rewrite the Friedmann equation. Here's the Friedmann equation again, the zero zero component of the Einstein equation. In the full glory with lambda spelled out and with k still in there. Now we put the lambda into the energy momentum tensor. So the rho total, the total energy momentum tensor's energy density is the energy density of matter plus the energy density that comes from the cosmological constant. So we will have only rho total. The lambda will be part of it. And secondly, we introduce a very important definition that comes up all over the place in cosmology, which is that we give a name to A dot over A. And A dot over A is called the Hubble parameter. Historically, people started with the Hubble constant because, as far as they could see, this thing did not depend on time. But now we know, of course, that in different epochs, the age will have different behaviors. So A dot over A is the Hubble parameter. So now let us rewrite the Friedmann equation in terms of the Hubble parameter, the A dot over A, and in terms of the total energy density. Then we get this equation here. And what we see is that given the Hubble parameter, given the ratio of A dot over A, which, by the way, you can measure at what rate the universe is expanding, given given the H at a given point in time, you can ask, what value does the total energy density have so that K is equal to zero? You see, if you measure this, and you measure that, you can tell what this is. So we are asking, under which condition is the universe flat? And what we see is that if we want k to be zero, then this better matches that. So that means that for any value of the Hubble parameter, there is a critical energy density for which the universe is flat, for which the universe is R3. If the energy density is different from that, then the universe is either positively or negatively curved. It's either a sphere, a three-dimensional sphere, or it's a three-dimensional hypersphere. So there's a critical energy density for which this is equal to that. You get it by dividing the h squared by this expression here. That's what it is, right? H squared and then divided by 8 pi g over 3. So this is the critical energy density there. Now, how close to the critical energy density are we now? And therefore, how close have we been to the critical energy density in the past? The ratio of the total actual energy density to the total critical energy density that would be needed to ensure that the universe is flat is called capital omega. Now, the critical energy density we just expressed in the previous equation here, critical energy density is 3 over 8 pi g h squared. So therefore, this omega, which is the ratio between total energy density and critical energy density, can be written in this form. We have this equation, therefore, right? I mean, you just multiply this over here and then plug in what the rho critical is. Remember, what we're interested in is this thing here, right? If this is 1, if capital omega is 1, then the universe is flat. Okay. So the Friedmann equation, in terms of omega, now takes this value, takes this expression here. And we have the h square of t on both sides. We can we get an expression of omega of t minus 1. So you see, you get omega of t minus 1, that's the h square of t over there. But the h of t squared can be expressed as a dot squared over a squared. You get that the a squares cancel out. You get just the a dot squared is left over. And therefore, the Friedmann equation becomes that omega of t minus 1 is equal to this. I put this equation in the box because it's super important. What we have on the right-hand side is, of course, k being either minus 1, 0, or 1. And here's the derivative of the scale factor. On the left-hand side is what we're really interested in. Omega is the ratio of the actual energy density to the critical energy density. If it's 1, the universe is flat. In other words, if this is 0, then the universe is flat. If this is larger or smaller than 0, then the universe is a sphere or a hypersphere. So now, let us calculate backwards through, for example, the matter-dominated epoch. We could also choose another epoch, but let's just assume that, I mean, we just calculate backwards through a few billion years through a matter-dominated epoch, just to do some explicit calculations. During matter domination, the scale factor goes like t to the power 2/3, which means that a dot, time derivative of the scale factor, goes like t to the power of minus 1/3. And that means that the square of it goes like t to the power of minus 2/3. And that means that omega of t minus 1 goes like k t to the power 2/3. We could do the same thing for radiation domination. I put it over here. All right. So what we get here is the time dependence of the deviation from flatness. Okay? That's the time dependence of the deviation from flatness. Especially if k is equal to 0 and we have flatness, it'll stay flat. Right? This is 1. But if it's not 0, then this deviation will grow. So either positive end will grow or negative end will grow, according to this. So let's evaluate that. Here is the deviation from flatness at time t1 and the deviation from flatness at some time t0. The ratio of the two, so how much the deviation from flatness changed over time is encoded in that ratio, is then t1 over t0 to the power of 2/3, simply by taking the previous equation and, you know, using it here and using it there. In this way, the kappa dropped out. Remember the, where is it? I don't know how to go to the previous page now. Okay. See, if I press the back button, it just shifts the screen. That's not what I want. Okay. So by dividing, by taking the equation that we had before at two different times and then dividing the two equations, the k dropped out. And we just got that here. Now let's check it with realistic numbers. We know that now the universe is pretty much flat. Just experimental evidence says that if we take a huge triangle with a rectangle in it, then Pythagoras' law is satisfied. Basically, the universe looks pretty much spatially flat at sufficiently large scales, like above 2 or 3 billion light years. So that deviation is really small, and let's generously say it's of order 1. So at time t1, the deviation from flatness is very small. But then let's look at much earlier. Time t0 is like 10 to the minus 6 t1. So if we are looking at 10 billion years now, then a millionth of that would be 10,000 years. So we go back to when the universe was 10,000 years old. Well, then that difference, the deviation from flatness, would then have to be of order 10 to the minus 4. Because we go from 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 4 by taking 2/3. So that means that if today the deviation from flatness is of order 1, then when the universe was 10,000 years old, its deviation from flatness was of order 10 to the minus 4. But 10,000 years, the universe was at some point much younger, right? So let's say we go to a time of 10 to the minus 30 seconds, 10 to the minus 30 times today, which is when the universe was 10 to the minus 11 seconds old, which is not a speculative time, because remember, 10 to the minus 11 seconds is as far back as we can probe the physics of the early universe in accelerator experiments. Well, then, if we plug that in here, we find that the deviation from flatness ought to have been of order 10 to the minus 24. That is tremendously flat. So only if the universe was at that early time so extremely flat, like order 10 to the minus 24, only then does it still present itself with the flatness that we see today. Flatness is not stable. The universe must have started out super flat, tremendous accuracy to be still as flat as we see it today. Now, what could be a solution to this fine-tuning problem? Is there a type of epoch in which this doesn't hold? I mean, we calculated it for radiation domination. Oh no, we calculated it for matter domination. For radiation domination, you can do the same calculation. You will find that it's similarly sensitive, similarly unstable. But now let's ask, is there a type of epoch in which the universe evolves towards flatness, not away from it? So that if it wasn't flat, the Einstein equation drives it towards flatness. And it was discovered by Robert Brout, François Englert, Stravinsky, Linde, and others. By the way, Englert got the Nobel Prize for the Higgs particle too. So he did two things. Actually, he did that with Brout, but Brout had passed away by the time the Nobel Prize was awarded. So only Higgs and Englert got the Nobel Prize for the Higgs. Brout should have gotten it, but he passed away a year before. He was actually a regular visitor here. It's a pity. Okay, so in order to find an epoch in which the universe is driven towards flatness, let's look at the equation that we had derived earlier. The deviation from flatness is this, right? If omega is the ratio between the actual energy density and the critical energy density, if that's 1, then we have flatness. So if this is 1, minus 1 is 0. So if this is 0, then we have flatness. So the deviation from flatness scales over time like this. And what we can see from that is that when A dot is increasing, then the right-hand side is decreasing, which means this is driven towards 0, which is to say towards flatness. So if and only if A dot is increasing, then the universe is driven towards flatness. So what we need for the universe to be driven towards flatness is that A double dot is larger than 0, right? So that A dot is increasing. But we, earlier in this lecture, encountered that criterion before in a definition. We said that all epochs in which A double dot is larger than 0 is called, all epochs in which this is the case are called inflationary epochs. So what we need is an inflationary epoch to explain how it could be that the universe is so flat. And we could, of course, just postulate it as an initial condition. But that would be a weird thing. It's much better to have an explanation for things. And we know from a little calculation we did earlier that this happens, that we have inflationary epochs, exactly if and only if the W parameter of the epoch is smaller than minus one-third. Because remember, the case of W equal one-third was the case where the A of T curve did not slope upwards, did not slope downwards. It was just a straight line. It was just proportional to T. That was for the case of W smaller than minus one-third. So any equation of state with a W smaller than minus one-third will stabilize or will make the universe go towards flatness. And we call that an attractor, because it doesn't really matter how it started out. It will end up flat. The universe might have started out with positive curvature. It ends up with zero. It might have started with negative curvature. It ends up with zero, because the sine of k doesn't matter. As a dot is increasing, this goes to zero. And therefore, the energy density approaches the critical energy density. Therefore, we get flatness. Now, what are the experimental constraints on this? Well, it's been found that in order to account for the amount of flatness that we see in the universe today, we need that such a period of inflation has lasted at least 60 E folds, which is to say the ratio of the scale factor before and after. This should actually be the other way around, after divided by before. That ratio should be about e to the power 60. There are many models of cosmic inflation which exceed that by far. Natural models of inflation often have here powers of thousands or even 10 to the thousand or something like that. I mean, e to the power 10 to the thousand. Okay, so this is a natural, this provides us with a natural explanation for why the universe might look so flat today. It's because no matter how it was at the very beginning, who knows what the very beginning really was, after it underwent a sufficiently long period of inflationary expansion, accelerated expansion, it was driven towards flatness. You can think of it like taking a wrinkly balloon and blowing it up. It's actually not a very accurate description, because actually it's more like this if you study it carefully. It's like you take a wrinkly balloon, and in the case of space-time, as you blow it up, it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. The wrinkles do not get ironed out, but they become bigger. And that means that locally, if you look at them at the scale of like a centimeter, they look flatter and flatter. It's not because the wrinkles actually go away, they just get bigger. But if you keep looking at a particular fixed scale, it looks flatter then. You see, we didn't calculate that here, because we made the assumption that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. We didn't consider wrinkles here. But if you do the calculation with the wrinkles, that's what you find. Which is a bit of a concern, because imagine the universe started out with curvature present in a fractal way, where you would have curvature at all length scales. Classically, you could imagine that, right? So you have curvature of wavelengths like a kilometer, you have curvature of wavelengths like a meter, curvature of wavelengths 100 nanometers, and you have curvature of wavelengths of picometers and 10 to the minus 30, 10 to the minus 100 meters, and whatever. Classically, anything goes. So you could have curvature at all length scales. And if that's so, then inflation doesn't help. Because what you get is that what is now of wavelengths a meter, yeah, that will be blown up huge and then look flat. But you've also blown up curvature of from smaller length scales. That's now taking its place. And so you keep getting a wrinkly universe. If you have a fractal type of curvature distribution, it just stays like that. However, we don't think that there is ordinary space-time at length scales smaller than 10 to the minus 35 meters. So therefore, while classically we could have a fractal distribution of curvature, quantum theoretically that's not plausible. It could well be that it's basically the fuzziness of space-time at the Planck scale which prevents this fractal behavior from occurring and which therefore makes it safe to consider the universe becoming flat because of inflation. I mean, that it takes the wrinkles out, right? That there are no more wrinkles coming up from below. Now, that's all just intuition, but what we will do next term is actually calculate the evolution of little wrinkles and where they come from. There could be wrinkles that are classically pre-imposed one way or the other. We will not assume that there are such. But quantum fluctuations always produce a bit of a wrinkling. Because when you have quantum fields, they will fluctuate. And that will lead to fluctuations of the energy momentum tensor. And that leads to fluctuations of the curvature. So therefore, even though the universe is assumed to initially have expanded at an accelerating rate, which should flatten everything out, quantum fluctuations, which are always at work, will repopulate the space-time with fluctuations, with curvature fluctuations all the time. So the universe gets flattened by the expansion, but always imprinted with some fluctuations because of quantum fluctuations, with some curvature because of quantum fluctuations. And that's the standard model of cosmology nowadays, where we think that the universe is pretty much flat because of the accelerated expansion, but still it has structure. And that structure is not structure that's a remnant from pre-inflationary epochs. No, that structure was imprinted by quantum fluctuations during the epoch of inflation. Of course, all of that will come later. Okay, so the conjecture of an early inflationary epoch, as we drew in that logarithmic timescale, was initially introduced to explain the flatness problem, but it turns out to explain many other things as well, which is why it's the standard model now. So in particular, it explains the absence of exotic high-mass particles that would likely have been produced close to the Planck time and only then, like magnetic monopoles and other particles might have been produced then. And we should ask, why don't we see them around? And well, if they have been produced, fine. But there was so much expansion that they would have been diluted. So they are there, but just very, very, very rare. Also, we have to ask, how could it be that after the inflationary period, the universe was suddenly filled with a lot of hot plasma, which is needed to explain the beginning of the Big Bang? Now, the model of an early inflation can be extended to explain why the universe did this accelerated expansion. And that explanation answers why the universe was then filled after inflation with a high density of matter. I already gave it away like half an hour ago by saying that this was when the universe, when the inflaton field's potential dropped to zero, and then all of that inflaton potential energy became the turned into the production, was turned into particles. Okay, so the currently favored solution to this question, namely how was the universe filled with matter afterwards, goes like this. The inflationary epoch occurred when a scalar field, that is now called inflaton field, had a large potential just because of a quantum fluctuation. So because of a quantum fluctuation, the energy momentum tensors component for a Klein-Gordon field, for a inflaton field, behaved like this. Here we have the energy density. Here's the T0 component of the energy momentum tensor for an inflaton field. It consists of this kinetic term plus the potential, and the pressure also has a kinetic term
minus the potential.
And as we discussed earlier, when the potential of a scalar field is very, very large, then we get a large energy density. Obviously, it's a potential, so it should contribute to the energy density. But the potential of a scalar field also produces a pressure. It contributes to the II components of the energy momentum tensor, and negatively. That's the curious thing about scalar fields. Their potential contributes negatively to the pressure. And when the potential is very large, and by very large is meant larger than these kinetic contributions, larger than the time scale of change of the inflaton field, then the ratio of pressure over the energy density, which is to say the W parameter, is the ratio of minus V divided by V, which is minus 1. So if a scalar field happens to have, at least locally and temporarily, a potential that's very large and dominates over everything else, then in that patch where that happens, the W parameter is close to minus 1, which will make that patch expand exponentially. But then when inflation ends, when we roll down that potential, and we will discuss that later in a later lecture, when the field phi evolves such that it comes down from the high value of V of phi to a small value or to zero, then all of that potential goes into the production of all sorts of particles, and we end up with a hot plasma. This is the period of reheating, or this is the moment of reheating. It's meant to have happened really fast. Okay. Now, the conjecture of an early inflationary epoch, the existence of an early inflationary epoch, also solves the so-called horizon problem. We are almost reaching our time horizon here. So, horizon problem. If we look out in the sky at the cosmic microwave background in one direction, we can measure its temperature there. It's about 2.7 Kelvin. Remember, the cosmic microwave radiation started out as the heat radiation of the hot plasma when it underwent the phase transition to become a hydrogen and helium gas, which was then transparent, has been traveling 13.8 billion years, and cooled down from on the order of 1,000 degrees to now 2.7 degrees. It has 2.7 degrees, and we can actually measure this temperature to like 7 digits behind the comma. And then we measure the temperature in that direction of the CMB, and it's the same. Now, the photons that we see coming from there were emitted by a plasma over there very far away, like 13.8 billion light years away. Actually further away, because since it was emitted, the universe expanded quite considerably since. And similarly, the photons that we see coming from over there were emitted by a hot plasma over there, very far over there. And now, I have to ask, why do they have the same temperature? Were they ever in contact? Well, we have to, in order to find out whether these two stretches of plasma were ever in contact, we have to calculate, I mean, now they are so far away from each other, they're not in any contact. But if we follow that back in time, then they were closer. But how close were they when that was emitted? And what you find is that actually, if you follow back the CMB radiation from this direction, that direction, then you see one was emitted by this patch of gas, another part was emitted by that patch of gas or plasma. And then if you take this patch of plasma and look at its back light cone, all the stuff that it was influenced by, back to the Big Bang, and here back to the Big Bang, then if you don't assume a period of inflation, if you just assume some radiation domination or some matter domination or something, then you find that they could never have been in contact with each other. And therefore, there is no way that they could have equilibrated their temperature. So why would they be at the same temperature to so many digits behind the comma? But again, if you have an inflationary period, then that's very different. That picture would be very different because you have this almost exponential expansion, and that means that they were much closer, in fact, in contact. Right. And then finally, and that was not the initial intent, but it turned out that the conjecture of an early inflationary epoch in the universe also explains the occurrence and precise statistics of the inhomogeneities in the universe. How does it do that? Well, the quantum fluctuations of scalar fields, such as the inflaton field, it turns out, are being amplified in an inflationary epoch. This is a speciality that happens, a special behavior that happens for scalar fields and that happens for the metric. It doesn't happen for spinor fields or for vector fields such as the electromagnetic field or the weak or the strong gluon field. So it turns out that quantum fluctuations that are normally only visible at very, very long, very, very short length scales, during an epoch of almost exponential expansion, were actually frozen in size. This is a behavior that you should not think of as something weird quantumly, because it already occurs classically. Even if you just look at the classical field, a classical wave field, if you look at its behavior during an accelerated expansion, you find that it does something very weird. You can think of it this way. Imagine you have accelerated expansion in the universe, and you have two observers, you and a friend, and you have walkie-talkies, and you, or phones or whatever, and you phone with each other. Then it can happen that you lose contact with each other. And the reason is that even though the signals that you send from phone to phone are traveling at the speed of light, it could be that your friend is traveling so fast away from you because of the expansion of the universe that the light doesn't catch up with them. See, your friend is not traveling away at faster than the speed of light. No. There is more space created between you and your friend then light can cross at the time it needs to get there in time to meet your friend. So basically the rate at which light or your signal, your phone signal, is crossing space is not keeping up with the rate of space production between you two. That's a cosmological horizon, and we will discuss cosmological horizons soon. So two people can no longer communicate because more space is being created by the expansion of the universe at a rate higher than the rate at which a signal traveling at the speed of light can cross that space. Now, that's just the communication between two point observers by sending light signals. Now, and that's hindered or obstructed by the presence of this horizon that arises from the accelerated expansion. But what if you're looking at a wave now? Not two observers, but you're looking at a wave. And that wave can have a wavelength smaller than the horizon size or larger than the horizon size. Now, if the horizon size is huge and the wave is small, well, then you shouldn't really worry about the horizon. The wave should behave as usual. And it does. But if you solve the classical wave equation for waves whose wavelength is on the order of or larger than the horizon size, the maximum distance at which two observers can still communicate, you see, if you're far apart, then of course more space gets created between you. The further you are apart, the less likely it is you can still communicate, right? So if you look at large wavelengths, larger than the horizon, what does a wave do? And it turns out it stops oscillating. It's just a classical feature of wave equations when you run them on an expanding space-time. If the wavelength is larger than the horizon size, it stops oscillating. And when you apply that to a quantum field, it means that quantum fluctuations that are initially smaller than the horizon size, but then the universe expands and it stretches it above the horizon size, then this quantum fluctuation doesn't recollapse. It just stays as it is, and it becomes a huge quantum fluctuation, which can then decohere, become classical, and imprint itself as an inhomogeneity on the space-time. It all sounds pretty outrageous, but if you make predictions, they match what you measure. Anyways, I mean, that's basically what we will end up with. That calculation is what we will do next term. Okay, so the conjecture of an early inflationary epoch also explains the occurrence and precise statistics of inhomogeneities in the universe, namely by doing the quantum theory of waves, namely this inflaton field, of wavelengths smaller and then larger than the horizon length. And then we find that the quantum fluctuations that are normally only visible at very small scales actually become not just visible, but dominant in large scales. These fluctuations are thought to be the origin of the inhomogeneities in the temperature of this cosmic microwave background. Cosmic microwave background is not exactly the same temperature everywhere. It varies by like 10 to the minus 5. The ratio between the expectation value and the fluctuations is about 10 to the 5. Right. Okay, almost done here. Okay, so the cosmic microwave background. When a hydrogen gas is hotter than about 3000 Kelvin, as we discussed, it is ionized, it is a plasma. And these ions interact with light, so the gas is therefore opaque, because the light always runs into protons, electrons, these are charged, and therefore the light scatters off it. Below 3000 Kelvin, the phase transition happens, and the plasma becomes a gas. Hydrogen and helium gas are neutral and transparent. So the universe, filled with hydrogen gas, made that transition when it was about 100,000 years old. And the light prevalent at that time is still traveling and arriving from all directions. And this is actual temperature data. So if you go out and you measure the temperature on the surface of the sky as a function of the angle, you can visualize it in this way. This temperature distribution is very much exaggerated. These fluctuations are only one part in about 100,000. Now, in order to work out the statistics of this and then compare it with the theory of inflation, where you take the inflaton field, quantize it, look at the statistics of the quantum fluctuations, and then try to predict this. In order to do that comparison between theory and experiment, it's convenient to do something like a Fourier transform of that, to look at the statistics of the size of the fluctuations. But this is a pattern of fluctuations on the sky. It's like a 2D surface around us, like this. And the Fourier transform is not good for that. Fourier transform is good on R, or R2, or R3. No, on a surface, it's best to expand in the eigenfunctions of the angular momentum, the spherical harmonics. The spherical harmonics are the analog of plane waves for spheres, right? And then when you plot the spherical harmonics quantum number L to the right, this is the theoretical prediction, and that's the experiment. And today, the experimental data are even much better than this. Basically, the experiment and the theory are right on top of each other. The error bars are very small. Of course, you have free parameters on this that need to be fixed, but we view this as being able to read off those parameters as a measurement. Now, that theory was not the only theory that competed to describe the origin of structure in the universe. Another attempt at explaining the origin of structure in the universe has been that there was no such thing as inflation, but that instead, as the universe cooled down, it cooled down kind of too fast. If, for example, you take water and you cool it down and freeze it very fast, then you get ice, which is milky. If, however, you take water and you cool it down very, very slowly, you get ice, which is very clear. And the reason is that as you cool it down very slowly, the ice crystals that form can rearrange themselves so that they fit nicely together and you get large crystals. However, if you cool something down very, very quickly, then you get lots of tiny little ice crystals that don't have time to orient relative to their neighbors. And so you get lots of boundaries between ice crystals that are, you know, in different directions, and light scatters off those interfaces between those monocrystals there. And the idea is that in the universe it was similar. It went through various phase transitions, and they were so fast that you got non-trivial structure forming at the interfaces, like where the phase transition would be going one way or the other. In this case, it wasn't water going to ice. It was phase transitions in the standard model of particle physics. It's a bit more complicated to explain. But there, too, you have an analog of orientations. Just like orientations of a crystal of ice, you have orientations in an internal so-called isospinner space. And then again, you can have interfaces, and those interfaces would be cosmic strings or would be called cosmic textures. And they would be regions of elevated energy, just like in a crystal. When you have a crystal defect, it's a point of elevated energy, because the actual uniform crystal would be the lowest energy state. But elevated energy means elevated energy momentum tensor, and so you get curvature in there. That was a very viable theory at the time, but experimentally it was ruled out because the statistics of the fluctuations that it predicted didn't match the experimental ones. All right. Neil Turok was one of the proponents of that theory and the inventors of that theory of the phase transitions. Okay. Right, and this is just a nice picture I found somewhere of how one might imagine structure formation happened. Initially, quantum fluctuations would lead to some large-scale inhomogeneities, which then enhance themselves under gravitational collapse, and then you get clouds and eventually galaxies and stars. Right, and then I leave you here with an appendix which looks at the issue of wrinkles, right, and how wrinkles evolve in space-time, and how you then go about quantizing the evolution of these wrinkles, which of course classically is wrinkles, quantum mechanically is quantum fluctuations, just regular quantum fluctuations of a quantum field. And that's just a preview of the material that will come up next term when we do the quantum fluctuations. So I won't go into the appendix in the lecture, but I wrote it up for you anyway. Okay, that's it for today.